have consistently been up with President Obama. There's a reason he's called the deporter-in-chief. Now, there's been some relief, but a lot of the infrastructure that he built out continues to exist. ICE and Border Patrol are the largest police force in America, yet they have very little oversight. So imagine what would happen with an agency that's already rogue, that's already detaining citizens and violating the Constitution under someone like Donald Trump. So we understand the difficulties of the reality now and understand the dangers of having someone like Trump in control of that type of infrastructure.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Jacinta Gonzalez, field director of Mi Gente, a national political hub for Latinx organizing. We're going to continue the interview and post online at democracynow.org. That does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!'s 3 job openings. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. KBOO Community Radio has been broadcasting in Portland since 1968. Not only do we provide thought-provoking news, live performance, and excellent music, we provide broadcast training and access. We're asking you to help us celebrate KBOO by voting for us in Willamette Week's Best of Portland poll. Cast your vote during the nomination phase from now until March 31st. There are a few categories KBOO fits in, so write us in as often as you can. Also, don't forget to nominate your favorite shows and hosts, too. For more information, including a link to the poll online and category suggestions, go to kboo.fm/BOP2016. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today, we'll cover President Obama's visit to Cuba.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the film screening of Firefighters, Architects, Engineers, Expose 9/11 Myths on Saturday, April 2nd, at the Portland State University Lincoln Performance Center in Portland. The film will be introduced by Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. There will also be a Q&A session after the film. Again, that's a screening of the film, Firefighters, Architects, Engineers, Expose 9/11 Myths with Richard Gage, Saturday, April 2nd, at the Portland State University Lincoln Performance Center, 1620 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Tim DeChristopher Lecture, Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Tim DeChristopher, as bitter 70, disrupted a Bureau of Land Management oil and gas auction in 2008 by outbidding oil companies for land parcels around Arches and Canyonlands National Parks in Utah. His actions led to a 21-month imprisonment. Again, that's a lecture by Tim DeChristopher titled Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Problem with Privilege, a 4-week class hosted by the Portland Underground Grad School starting April 4th at 6:30 p.m. This class is for those who want to name and correct liberal racism, who want to understand and interrupt isms, and who want to be a powerful ally and take on race issues and white fragility without co-opting the issues. Again, that's The Problem with Privilege, a 4-week class hosted by the Portland Underground Grad School starting April 4th at 6:30 p.m. at Hatch, 2420 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Information on how to register for the class and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, a full-service automotive shop located next to Portland's Selwood Bridge for over 30 years. They're a Blue Seal certified shop committed to client care and community support. Information on their eco certification, client carbon neutral program, courtesy shuttle, rentals, and more at tomdwyer.com or by calling 503-230-2300.
Smooth sounds of the great Arturo Sandoval on KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm Abe Proctor. With me is Joe Uris. Welcome to the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program.
Oh, you sound so sweet,
man. Hey, thanks, man.
That's really nice. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio show. This is Portland, Oregon. 231-8187 is the number to call. We are going to talk about Cuba.
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 Viva Cuba Libre.
That's a drink, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. But there was before that there was rum and Pepsi and Coca-Cola with the Andrew sisters. Let's talk about stereotypes and let's talk about what is not stereotypical. Let's talk beginning with the history of Cuba and the United States.
Let's begin with this.
What shall we begin?
503-231-8187 is the number to take part in this conversation.
Well, I said that.
Did you?
You don't even notice what's happening.
I really don't. Yeah. Yeah, you just go in one ear and out the other.
Those drugs just will destroy your life.
Hey, but if you want to write into the show, you can do that at facebook.com/Abe and Joe or on the Twitter machine. I'm at HonestAbe72. Go ahead.
I think Honest Abe is kind of sweet.
Do you?
Yeah.
Oh, thanks.
It makes me picture you with a big hat and a tallness.
Yeah, special occasions.
And being shot.
Yeah.
Okay. Cuban Revolution. Okay. Mm-hmm. More than one.
Yep.
More than one. But the most interesting was an effort by Cuba to free itself in a civil war from Spain. Now Cuba had been a colony of Spain from the 1600s on.
Yeah.
And it was...
Earlier than that.
Earlier 1500s. Than that. 1500s, right. And in fact, it was a place where slaves from Africa were brought to work in Cuba and eventually in the sugar fields. Mm-hmm. And during that period of time, Spain was a nasty master. And in fact, Spain, in its imperial reach, went all the way from the Philippines and various colonies in Latin America, including Cuba. And the effort to free themselves, the Cuban people, beginning in the 1890s, became a real thing.
Yeah.
And the U.S., of course, was very interesting. I'm interested. I want to point out that beginning in the 18 teens or 20s, the slaveholding states wanted to annex Cuba so they could have more slave operation.
Which makes sense.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Right.
Why not? Yeah. But that did not get accomplished until 1898, when the United States essentially got into an effort to destroy the Empire of Spain, both in the Philippines and in Latin America. There had already been revolutions in most of the Latin American countries.
Wait, the United States got involved in an effort to destroy the Empire of Spain?
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, endlessly.
That's a very broad statement.
Well, it's true. It's endlessly elaboratable.
Wait, are you suggesting the United States of America embarked on an imperialist adventure?
Oh, yes.
In the Spanish-American War?
Oh, yes.
That we did it explicitly to acquire more territory?
Oh, yes.
And project military power farther abroad?
Absolutely.
I thought we didn't do that sort of thing.
We always do that sort of thing. What do you think? What do you think Vietnam was? What do you think?
No. We only fight, Joe, where freedom is at stake. We only fight to advance the ideals of democracy and representative government.
Freedom's just another word for nothing left to grab.
Oh, you better write that down.
I'm gonna write that down. Okay, so in that Cuban Revolution, the United States became involved and essentially got a hold of Puerto Rico. Cuba, numerous other islands, and of course the Philippines.
Philippines,
which we held, which we held. The Philippines we held until essentially the Japanese. I'm going to put quotes on this because it was a pretty horrible thing. Liberated the Philippines. Thereafter, in 1947, the Philippines became their own nation state, but totally tied to the United States, both economically and in terms of bases to fight the Soviet menace and the Chinese menace. Mm-hmm. So we have been involved internationally in places that had been part of the Spanish Empire. Now, it's important to understand that essentially we supported every government that came along as long as it was a puppet government.
Yeah.
And we didn't mind when the mafia took over large parts of the hotel trade and other businesses, gambling and so on in Cuba. We didn't mind when Havana became the go-to place for people looking for whores, drugs, and fun.
Right. So, and let's not forget that the natural wealth generated by Cuba, mostly in the form of sugar production and other agricultural products, all that wealth was appropriated both by foreign investors, mostly from the United States, and by the ruling class in Cuba, who was a textbook situation of capitalistic exploitation, and really a blueprint for the global capitalism that has followed.
Well, but it was, in fact, an oligarchical situation and a series of revolutions by so-called reformers produced nothing in the way of freedom for the Cuban people. This all culminated, really, I'm going to jump ahead, there's so much information, I'm going to jump ahead to the Cuban Revolution, which was led by Fidel Castro and others, 1959.
Right, as a violent reaction to the capitalist exploitation.
Right. And these were people who had learned from various writers, including Marx, the notion of socialism and the notion of the ideal state being a state which is owned theoretically, I say theoretically, by the people, and that it would be governed in along certain lines. Now, it was a totalitarian regime. It was a part of the model. The model for it was really the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
The CIA became very upset, very upset. And beginning in 1959, they began to train people who had fled from Cuba, people who were opportunists from Cuba, and people who are freedom fighters from Cuba. And this went on and on and on. And the United States attempted to invade Cuba from Central America in the belief that the Cuban people were so unhappy that they would join the revolution as soon as the Bay of Pigs happened, as soon as the Americans led powers arrived.
So how'd that work out for us?
Not well.
Not well.
Not well. Those who survived were prisoners, and they would show tried, and we ended up trading those people for trucks and dump trucks and tractors and other building equipment.
Ah.
Yeah. Fair trade.
So it didn't work so well.
Well, that worked out fine from the point of view of getting the people the hell out of there, because it was the ruling class in Cuba was getting shot.
Yeah.
The slogan was to the wall, to be shot. But it's really important to understand that that was a CIA adventure, and it was a misadventure extremely well, how shall I say, not well thought out, but well imagined. And it was that group of people in the CIA still around, those that were alive, but their sons and daughters are still around. And that is part of the CIA mandate to reverse the enemies of the United States, to kick them out, to get rid of them.
I see.
So that did not work well. And in consequence of that, Fidel Castro and his leadership group turned to the Soviet Union, which was eager to help Cuba.
Indeed, and also eager to put some nuclear missiles in Cuba.
Well, that was the problem. You see, and Americans really don't understand this. At this point in history, the United States had nuclear missiles in Turkey, which could strike the heartland of the Soviet Union at any given moment. And those missiles are very important from the point of view of the Soviet Union, not to mention the United States. So the response of Nikita Khrushchev was a vast gamble, in which they thought, I don't know why they thought this, that they could get missiles installed and operational in Cuba before the United States became aware of it.
Didn't happen.
Didn't work out well. No, our people found out about it, And there was something called the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1961. So revolution in 59, Cuban Missile Crisis in 61.
Now, for those of us, including myself, who weren't alive at that time, talk about how fearful an occasion that was and how close we really came to nuclear war with the Soviet Union.
Well, we came very close. Had, in fact, had the military advisors in the CIA been followed by Kennedy, we would have had a nuclear war. We were really actually, you know, a few minutes away from such a war. What happened initially was a confrontation played out at the UN with Adlai Stevenson as our UN rep, saying, you know, I'm going to stand here till, well, hell freezes over, because we know this is true. Here's pictures of it. It's a real thing. The missiles were not operational at that point, but ships, big ships, were steaming toward Cuba from the Soviet Union, and there already were missiles in place, and they were being armed.
Right.
So it was a real touch-and-go situation.
There was a naval blockade set up.
So, yeah, our response was to set up a naval blockade and to make really foul promises. And, in fact, I think the U.S. was justified in saying, no, you know, you can't put these nuclear-headed missiles that close to the United States. That's not a good idea. However, it was a situation where nobody wanted to back down, and the military in the United States would say, let's hit them, we can do it. This is the chance. This is the Curtis LeMay mindset.
Whom?
Curtis LeMay.
Who was?
Who was a general who actively supported the idea of having a nuclear war and a ground war with the Soviet Union and China, who was thought to be a client state of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Wrong thinking, it turned out. But the assumption was that we could, with our vast superiority of nuclear power and presumably of our wonderful armed forces, take over all of these captured countries of the captured by communism. That was the idea. And it was a stupid idea. But it is the same idea that led us to an assumption about what was happening in Southeast Asia that led us into the disastrous war in Vietnam. Now, interestingly, just a sidebar, the Vietnamese saw their revolution as their revolution. And eventually, after we were defeated in Vietnam, let's be clear, we were defeated in Vietnam. After we were defeated in Vietnam, the Vietnamese had a war with China and defeated China. Did you know that?
I did not.
That is a true fact. So, you know, it's all much more complex than we pretended. There was no monolithic communist menace. Many nations had their own trips going on under the rubric of a socialism or a Soviet-style state. At any rate, in 1961, a number of things happened. First of all, Kennedy proved to be very, very brilliant in that he did not start a war. And he continued to negotiate. Khrushchev suddenly realized, I guess, or not so suddenly, but realized that he'd blundered, that he was not in a position to have this war, that it didn't make any real sense. Remember, a nuclear war is not the same as a ground war or an air war of the old style.
Or any other kind of war.
Yeah, it's totally different. It turns the world into dust. So at that point, there was a pause, a short pause, in which Khrushchev sent a long letter essentially saying, look, he did not say it this way, but what it amounted to was, okay, you know, we see we're going to have to remove the missiles, but we got to get something out of this. And what we want out of this is the removal of the missiles in Turkey. And that was agreed to. And, you know, what's interesting about that is back in the 60s, when Wayne Morse was an Oregon senator and an opponent of the Vietnam War, I had a chance to meet with him in a small gathering of students. And I asked him about these missiles in Turkey. And he actually either did not know or willingly lied to me and said his president had nothing to do with, there was no missiles. He disappeared them in his own mind, if not in reality.
Wow.
And that was pretty amazing.
That's weird.
Yeah, well, no, it was the tenor of the times. Lying was in style.
Oh, I see.
And I think Wayne Morse was one of the good guys among the liars.
It hasn't gone out of fashion.
So. Oh, no, it just never goes out of fashion. So anyway, the crisis of 61, you cannot believe the amount of fear. I knew people here in Portland, Oregon, who fled to Canada. For real.
Wow.
I know people who expected at any point in their lives to have their lives be ended by a nuclear war. I remember demonstrations in Portland, Oregon, and elsewhere all over the country against the war, the coming, assumed coming nuclear war, but also pro-Castro, I mean, anti-Castro Cubans marching around with effigies of Castro downtown. I mean, it was weird. It was amazing. Hmm. And it really did suddenly make a lot of people wake up to the possibility, actual possibility, of a nuclear war. Because it was very close. After that, the United States did agree to remove the missiles from Turkey very quietly. And after that, the United States and Cuba settled down to a kind of hate relationship. One of the things that came out of that was that any Cuban who fled Cuba and arrived in the United States became an instant citizen as soon as they hit the beach.
Interesting. They got to jump to the front of the line, huh?
That way to the front of the line. Nothing like that has exists for any other person coming here, except I think a few Central Europeans who came here.
Hmm.
So what really created was two classes of immigrants: Cubans with absolute rights to be here once they hit the beach, and anybody else from Latin America with no rights to be here.
I see.
Even though their ancestors might have been here way back.
So most of the Cubans immigrants settled in South Florida.
Well, they settled in South Florida and elsewhere.
Elsewhere, but concentrated heavily
right.
in South
Florida. But a good thing did happen. We found in New York and elsewhere Cuban Chinese or Chinese Cuban food, which is one of the best cuisines in the world. I just want to point that out. It's absolutely unimportant, but significant if you like to eat. Okay. Anyway. The relationship between the United States and Cuba continued to be bad in a variety of ways.
Well, the embargo was passed not long after the missile crisis.
Right, the embargo.
Which persists to this day.
Well, and the embargo had the advantage of not being a real war. It did create a situation, though, where the Cuban people became more and more dependent on the Soviet Union.
Indeed, it did.
And until the Soviet Union collapsed, that was the situation.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM. Talking about Cuba. Why? Because President Obama is there
right
today.
And a couple of things that are really important to understand about what's happening right now and what happened in the past. In the course of this process of embargo and in the course of all of this, Cuba kind of got frozen in the 50s.
Yep.
In many ways. Most attractively, they had to use their old 1940s, 50s, and a few 60s, very few 60s, automobiles as their cars.
Right, which they still do.
Which they still do, and is now becoming a tourist attraction.
My mom and dad went to Cuba last year.
Did they?
Yeah.
Did they have a good time?
They had a great time.
Well, it's a nice country.
Yeah, that's what
people
I hear.
People are nice.
Yeah.
Cheap. It's cheap. Comparatively.
It's a significant, though, this thawing in relations, because this has long been a symbolic thing in the United States, particularly among conservative Americans.
Wow.
Because of Cuba's relative proximity to the United States and the fact that a communist regime existed just a few miles off the coast of Florida. So conservatives were going to oppose any opening of relations with Cuba for pretty much any reason.
Right.
It was an article of faith. And that's really the source of most of the criticism regarding the president's trip now.
And what Castro did, one of the clever things that the Castro government did was to allow anybody to leave who wanted to at a certain point. And a lot of criminals, a lot of sleazeballs, a lot of dope dealers, a lot of whatever, moved to the United States, were briefly in concentration camps here, and then went out and created what was a big drug crisis with cocaine.
Well, I don't know that they created it.
Well, I mean, there was always a demand.
But they profited by the trade.
Profited indeed.
Oh, let's take a phone call. What do you say?
Okay.
George, good morning.
Hey, good morning. And this is terrific background stuff, terrific historical coverage. Thank you so much, both of you, for this. And I have a biography of Kennedy, his political presidency, and it's by a guy named Jim Douglas, and I think probably both of you know about it, and you've probably both read it. And in looking through the book and having read the whole thing, I noticed at the beginning a chronology section, and in it there's two places where President Kennedy, according to Douglas, was talking with some people on the National Security Council, and a subcommittee of the National Security Council apparently cleared the office and said, look, there's a window of opportunity, Mr. President, during which the United States could launch a, and I'm quoting from the words in Douglas's book on page Roman numeral 22, a window of opportunity during which the U.S. could launch a preemptive nuclear attack on the Soviet Union in late 1963, preceded by a period of heightened tensions. President Kennedy, according to Douglas here, walks out of the meeting saying to Secretary of State Dean Rusk, quote, and we call ourselves the human race. And then again, a few pages later on, it's Roman numeral page 27. This is September 12, 1963, and the earlier one was in 1961. Virtually the same thing happened at a National Security Council meeting. The Joint Chiefs of Staff again present a report evaluating a projected nuclear first strike against the Soviet Union. And President Kennedy this time was ready for them, and he started asking them questions about how many people would die on both sides. And after a few of these back and forths, apparently the Joint Chiefs of Staff realized that the president was not about to participate in this plan. So I just wondered if you've heard of this, and do you know?
Well, yes, actually, and I have a personal belief, no evidence, I want to really emphasize that, no hard evidence, that Kennedy's murder had a lot to do, and how it happened and so on, I don't have. So I can't really say it's true.
Uh-huh.
But there seems to me to be some evidence that the CIA really didn't enjoy Kennedy. And and really, I have always been suspicious about the Dallas event. Again, I don't have any hard evidence. I don't have a theory of a second gun or a third gunman or whatever the hell. And I can't say that it wasn't a single man. I can't say any of that. But hey, I gotta let you go because the bell rang.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for calling. I do want to emphasize that what really happened in Cuba was that the Soviet Union collapsed.
Yeah, that's really what happened.
Now, before that happened, though, Cuba was a major supporter of revolution throughout the throughout Latin America. Also, it involved itself in the Angolan struggle with a huge army. And in fact, was a supporter of revolution in both Africa and in Latin America.
That's true.
And that's real.
Yeah.
And so that was a major part of our concern.
I also want to touch on something the caller mentioned. He mentioned the historical background that we're providing. If you're a longtime listener of the show, you've probably noticed that that's a recurring thing, because I think I can speak for both Joe and myself when we say that context is so important in interpreting current events. And what's lacking from so much news coverage today is that sense of context. So if you're wondering why we often devote time at the top of the show to background, that's why.
Well, and then we have disasters like Rubio.
And Cruz
and all these other weird people. I mean, look, the Cold War and its outcomes have produced a lot of warping and bad stuff throughout the world.
Warping and bad stuff.
That's the kind of technical language I like to use.
Yeah, that's right.
I like to use that. And it's very clear to me. I really and truly believe that American foreign policy in that period was grossly warped by a set of assumptions about the intention of the Soviet Union in the world, which sometimes were true and sometimes were not true. But when the Soviet Union collapsed, Cuba suddenly found itself without its ability to survive economically. And that really brought Cuba to the place where it's at now. And what I think is going to happen, and makes me very, very sad, I do not object to trade with Cuba on an equal basis, but here's my prediction. Trump Towers in Havana.
Yep.
New modern cars, and the other cars become tourists. You pay lots to ride in the touristy 1954 Chevrolet or whatever. It's going to be a system also which resumes the same behaviors that led to the revolution on the part of ordinary Cubans. Prostitution will increase. There will be an increase in nightclub life. There will be a great wave of opportunistic behaviors. And in the consequence of that, all the advances that Cuba did make, and this is important to understand, Cuba made incredible advances in medical research. It provided the two things under the government that cannot be disputed. I mean, it's not a
healthcare and education.
Exactly. Yeah. But the most intelligent thing is to teach everybody to read and write. I mean, that is really bright.
That's smart, yeah.
And then to provide basic healthcare for everybody, which we don't have yet.
Right.
So, I mean, it's all pretty amazing, but I'm very sad. I'm glad that relations are opening up. I think it will make it better all the way around for the Cuban people, and that's good. But I also predict that years ago, I gave a talk at I think it was called the Red School or the Communist something school that met at the American Friends Service Committee offices. And I think I pissed everybody off because I said capitalism delivers the goods. And it was taken as if I thought capitalism was absolutely cool. My point was, this is a reality which we all are going to have to understand. This is a system which does one thing well, which is to deliver the goods. The costs are immense, but it delivers the goods.
Yeah, that's true.
And now we're going to see that same phenomenon in Cuba. And Cuba has no real choice because it has no economic base any longer.
So you think we're going to see a return to the days when foreign interests, mostly from the United States, expropriated Cuba's natural wealth?
I assume so.
And impoverished its residents.
I think so.
Oh, great. Well, we got that to look forward to.
I don't know about the impoverishment part, because it may be that it's a more enlightened form of capitalism that appears there. But I still say Trump Tower.
In any event, President Obama has become the first American president to visit Cuba in close to 80 years. I think President Wilson was the last one. 88 years, says Engineer Steve. And has enacted and set us on a course towards reconciliation and normalization of relations. I think that, generally speaking, this is a good thing this happens.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
When relations between countries thaw and become more friendly, inevitably that's going to lead to some positive results. Now, there's a downside, as you have speculated, Trump Tower in Havana. But it's a good thing, as is the coming rapprochement with Iran. I think these are both positive diplomatic steps taken by the Obama administration.
Well, I agree.
Credit where it's due.
Yeah, and I agree. It's probably the two good things that have come out of the Obama administration in international affairs at this point.
Let's go to the phones. Virginia, good morning.
Good morning. I was just wondering if I'm mistaken, but it seemed to me Americans had a great deal to do with the precipitation of Castro coming to power in the corruption of the government that was in place then and the corrupt lifestyle that was going on there.
Oh, definitely.
But I'm not sure what you mean.
You mentioned much about that in your history.
Well, I'm not sure whether you're saying that the U.S. sponsored Castro, which it did not, or whether you're saying that his appearance was a consequence of policies which, in general, the U.S. used to support whatever the hell government was in Cuba.
Well, I'm thinking of the latter, but I wouldn't overgeneralize it to say it was the American government that was sponsoring it, the corruption and graft. I think it was the American mafia that had played a great role in controlling the government there and the economy.
Well, I think that's true.
And American business interests, too.
I think both legit businesses and less than legit businesses dominated Cuba for a long, long time. And, of course, the sugar industry really liked Cuba, because it got us sugar at a good price and made a good profit for the large sugar holders. So,
well,
you
did make mention, I think, in your spiel on the radio. I mean, when not on the radio, but on the phone. You seem to have a recording now, but that mentioned the prostitution and all the kinds of.
Well, everything was live. all live
activities that were going on, that caused, you know, people to recognize the great injustices that were going on, and there was a great role of the Jewish mafia operating in Cuba at the time.
The Jewish mafia?
Are you talking about...
It wasn't the Italians that were there so much. I think that was...
You're talking about Meyer Lansky, I think, who, while Jewish, wasn't about Jews at all. It was about Meyer Lansky's opportunism and his connections, actually, with the traditional Italian mafia.
I don't think the Italians were so operative in Cuba, but that's not relevant so much as it was an American mafia that was had a lot to do with some of the great injustices that went
yeah,
on.
Yeah, I'm
power.
I'm very concerned and always cautious when people link ethnicity to whatever, as if it were some kind of precursor or legitimizer of an understanding of a political and economic event. And I don't think people being Italian in origin or Jewish in faith has much to do with it. Anyway, thank you very much for the call.
All right, coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Alternative Radio, Alan Moss speaks on the case for socialism. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints features an update on the resistance to Donald Trump's campaigning in Arizona. Also, a look at working with troubled youth and responding to violent police. And a focus on efforts to prevent farm workers and their communities from being exposed to carcinogens. At 11, on stage in Studio D, May Roberts features actress and author Lauren Weedman on her new book, Misfortune, Fresh Perspectives on Having It All from Someone Who Is Not Okay. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Andre Middleton interviews Oregon arts professional Carl Anala, who is a painter and musician. All this and more coming up today on KBOO, your community-supported radio station, 90.7 FM.
Yeah. And we're talking about the president's visit to Cuba and the opening up of relations with Cuba. And we should tell you that you can call us at 231-8187.
And you can write into the show at facebook.com/AbeandJoe or at Twitter. I'm at HonestAbe72.
I can't believe HonestAbe. Well, why 72?
I was born in 72.
Oh, you're such a child.
I know.
Who we got?
George. Good morning. What's on your mind, George?
Yeah, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
I just wanted to fill in your audience with a little more about our illustrious history leading up to our Cuban situation. First of all, General LeMay, his nickname was Bombs Away LeMay. And also in 1812, we invaded Canada, and we burned down their capital of York, which is now Toronto. And when the British burned down Washington, it was payback.
That's true.
In 1846... Winfield Scott took an army and went down to Santa Cruz and fought battle after battle.
Veracruz, but go ahead.
And so he got to Mexico City, and the Treaty of Mexico City, we got back, we got the southwestern United States. And, you know, you were talking about sugar and Cuba. Well, another source of sugar was the Hawaiian Islands, sugar and pineapple. And the people that raised sugar and pineapple had to pay a tariff to get it in the United States. Well, if they became part of the United States, they would have to pay that tariff. So they happened to have 200 Marines on board on the island in 89, and voila, the Hawaiian Islands became part of our country. In 98, the Spanish-American War, we kicked the Spanish out of the Philippines in a matter of a week, and the Filipinos said, geez, you guys, thanks a lot. You can leave now. But... We wanted to have an oil tanker ship base there, and that part of the world was becoming more and more important. And McKinley had an epiphany, President McKinley, and he thought that we should bring Christianity to the Philippines.
But it was already Christian.
Yeah, Spain had already done that, hadn't
they? He had overlooked the fact that the Jesuits had been there for 400 years doing their darndest to make the Filipinos Christian, and most of them were. So, I mean, the idea that we're the city on the hill that does no wrong is absolutely absurd. It's a shame that so few Americans know the history of their country.
Well, I agree, and in fact, I don't want to get into a long discourse on the Philippines, but we waged war against Philippine Liberation Forces, which involved, guess what, waterboarding. A little different than today. We would shove a tube up both ends of a human being and have water come in from some height. Very painful.
Well, one general said, kill every Filipino over the age of 10. The war went on until Teddy Roosevelt finally declared, it's over. That was in 1905.
Yeah. No, it was a long war.
But anyway, guys, I love your show.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for listening.
Thanks for doing it.
Okay, take care, man. Bye. I think that it's... one of the things that is important to understand, and I taught U.S. history for a long, long time, and we have to demythologize American history, because all of us in the public school systems, or for that matter, in Catholic education in this country, learn a very warm, touchy-feely, friendly, good guy notion of American history, and unlike what we really should be learning, which is just the facts. Just the facts, man.
Agreed. Yeah, there's a story we're really fond of telling ourselves as Americans. And it's all wrapped up in notions of freedom and liberation and self-expression and fulfillment of some sort of national manifest destiny. But we tend to gloss over the really ugly parts that are mixed in there.
Well, it's a very dangerous situation now. We are actually seeing we are reaping the disastrous consequences of the assumptions and the mythologies. We're going to see this in the current 16 election. I mean, it's really creepy, and it's really real. But coming back to Cuba and coming back to the president's visit there, it is a mixed bag. Cuba will benefit, we will benefit from open trade and from opportunities. But the Cuban culture that evolved traditionally and post-revolution will, I suspect, be destroyed by capitalism.
Let's go back to the phones. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. Hasta la victoria to total victory. Thanks for your truth-telling and your demythologizing. I was actually on a hijacked plane. It was a Miami to Chicago flight, and we were told to stay away from the cockpit area. We'd be arriving in Havana International Airport in a few minutes. They kept us at the airport until it was dark, and then they took us to the Havana Hilton. And the unforgettable memory that I have is that Cuba is in this time of a special emergency in the 70s. Mm-hmm. It was a place of without any neon, without any advertising. A country really just devoted to its essentials. You know, you could see people waiting at bus stops, but there's no advertising. I wonder whether Americans can understand different cultures and the post-material challenge. It's very exciting to try to be an internationalista and to be learning from other people. And hopefully Sanders, we elect a Jewish prophet and we become part of the world of nations again.
I'm going to pass over the notion of Sanders as a prophet, but I will say this, and I think it's important to understand. There are real consequences to the transition from a kind of totalitarian socialism, which does involve the enslavement, the imprisoning of dissenters. That's number one. Number two, it is the case that Cuba is one of the places, more charming places in the world. Now, how the Cuban people feel about that, when they can look 90 miles away and see people prospering in the traditional American manner, and not realize that not everyone has that advantage in the United States, that's really a compelling thing. And I think it's going to be very difficult for the existing Cuban government, particularly with its leadership being old and particularly because it's not a democracy, all of that is going to lead to some major changes, which I believe will be turning Cuba essentially into a tourist trap.
I wish we could move to a global happiness index.
I think it's a great idea.
Gross domestic product, you know?
Well, it's a nice idea, and I appreciate the thought. Yeah. However, I think capitalism delivers the goods. Anyway, I want to thank you for the call, man.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Do you think I'm wrong to say capitalism delivers the goods?
No, I don't think you're wrong, but it's a statement that benefits from context.
I think you're right.
Yes.
Okay, 231-8187.
Who's next, Steve?
Talking about the excitement. LJ.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hey, thank you for the conversation. Okay, just a couple of quick points. I'll get off the phone. The role of the Bacardi family in the Cuban Revolution. It's my understanding that they, that the Bacardi family actually, in truth and in fact, did fund Fidel and Che.
The rum producers?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They got to do some with that sugar cane.
I guess so.
Yeah, I don't know anything. I don't know anything about that, so I can't comment on that.
Okay. Well, in truth and in fact, Joe, the Bacardi family did fund Fidel, but and Che in the revolutionary effort. But when Fidel and Che started to take over land that belonged to the oligarchs, the Bacardi family moved to Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. Second point, literacy in Cuba after Fidel and Che took over. Did they not educate the peasants?
Yes.
Make a reference to Paulo Freire's book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed.
Right.
The first thing that they did was like educate. And the educational system in Cuba is the best in the Caribbean. Can we talk about the free medical school in Cuba?
Mm-hmm.
If you aspire to be a doctor, you get your medical education.
In fact, a lot of the research, groundbreaking research in medicine that's taking place in the world now is actually taking place in Cuba.
That's true, Joe, in truth and in fact. And they already have a resort recovery hospital / hotel in place in Cuba now, where people from all over the world, with the exception of the U.S., go to recover. It's a wonderful facility. I heard all about it on Al Jazeera. The corporate media here in the USA will not touch that story with a 10-foot pole.
You're right about that.
I'm sorry?
I said I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah, okay, cool. So anyway, I think that Cuba, that the Cuban people have to be very, very careful about dealing with the Imperial Empire, because the Imperial Empire has a way of, how can I put this, infecting the system.
Yeah, what I say is capitalism delivers the goods. That's my ironic comment on that.
Yeah, really, really, Joe. Really, really. Anyway, again, one more quick point. As a result of the embargo, the Cuban people had to grow their own food,
mm-hmm.
and they are growing their veggies in an organic manner. Anyway, thank you for the show. Have a great day.
Take care, man.
Keep on keeping on, brother.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call.
All right.
Who's next? Cheryl, good morning.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. I have Joe, you've touched something so precious to me I hadn't thought about in quite a number of years. I was 18, starting PSC, Portland State College at the time, October, and I thought I knew everything, which proved not to be true, of course. But I was one amongst that throng of people who were demonstrating that time on the federal post office steps, which I don't think that's what the building is any longer as a usage, across from the old Myron Frank building.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember so many people were so agitated, and I got to go up there finally. I was expressing my tone at the time that I thought we should get out. I thought it was wrong for us to be in there and so on. And so that was great, and thanks for touching that old memory for me. And second, I want to say that there is a film called The Buena Vista Social Club.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, wonderful film.
It is. And for anyone who hasn't seen that or wants to refresh their memory, it is just a great film to see what actually much of the Cuban area looked like at the time it was filmed, which I think was in the late 80s or early 90s.
It's worth it for the soundtrack alone.
Absolutely. I think Ry Cooder is on there and several people.
Well, Ry Cooder has been a wonderful supporter of world music, actually.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, oh, right. He does everything. That's true. And the last thing I do want to say is for whatever feelings individuals have about President Obama, there are many different intelligences, and I think he, you know, he's right up there. But social intelligence is one of the best skills that anyone can have, and I think this man has it, and in years to come, it will be proved that he really did a lot of excellent things socially that gave people a sense of worth, a sense of, hey, you know, there are still things to fight for. Let's don't chew each other up the way the world is going. So those are just points. And again, Joe, thanks. Those are things I haven't told my children that I did, and now I'm going to tell my kids. I did a lot of demonstrating. So.
Well, I think it's actually that last point you touched on is very important. Our personal histories, as they relate to the world, the real world, are very, very important. And we should instruct our children.
Yes.
Teach your children well, I believe is the
That's right.
From the song?
Protest as an inherited value. I love
it. Yeah, exactly. So I've got a lot to tell those kids that I just never thought they'd be interested in, but who knows? Maybe they will be. So.
Well, I don't know. You can always show them footage of wild teenage fun or something.
Yeah, right. Okay, thanks so much.
Yeah, bye. Thanks for the
thanks
call.
Thanks for the call. Brian writes in to say, I don't think that Obama has much to slap Cuba on the wrist in terms of human rights, where there is a large population of political prisons and minor offenders in the U.S., led by Leonard Peltier, cops shooting black folks without recourse, lack of universal health care and other basic human rights like a roof over everyone's head and clean water in so many places. These among so many other issues. Also, Cuba hasn't invaded nor made war on anybody. I think the best gesture Obama could make is to restore Gitmo to Cuba, who'd most likely make better use for it. I'm glad Brian wrote in to say these things because, as I'm sure those of you who either listened to President Obama's speech earlier today or will read or watch about it later, you'll hear him offering a lot of platitudes about freedom, about human rights, about political dissidents, and so on. Really, if you have a clear-eyed look at United States history, it's hard to hear those things with a straight face. It doesn't make the president incorrect, but it also doesn't own up to our own legacy. And it was fascinating, the press conference that Presidents Obama and Castro had, in which they both sort of traded barbs at one another's countries. Obama was pushing Cuba on the issue of political dissidents, and Castro hit him right back on our lack of health care, our decaying educational system, and so on. It was a fascinating thing to watch.
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed that. I did miss that, and it's my own fault. I do want to make one point clear. Cuba did, under the influence of the Soviet Union and under the influence of its own ideological notions of spreading socialism, did involve itself in overseas adventures, particularly in Africa, and we must not forget that.
No,
I mean we were in the Cubans were in Congo for a long, long time.
Brian wrote and mentioned Gitmo. Gitmo is the shorthand name for the naval base
at Guantanamo
that
Bay.
We maintain at Guantanamo Bay on sort of the southeastern end of Cuba. And he's calling for that to be returned to the Cuban government. I'm going to make a prediction right now and say that ain't going to happen.
Well, no, because we have the unconvicted, untried, alleged terrorists there, and the Republican Party in the United States doesn't even want them to come to prison in the United States,
let alone
give them a trial.
Not just that, but its geopolitical strategic value is too high, I'm sure, for our military to let it go.
I'm not sure of its actual military value for us.
It really commands a whole big section of the Caribbean.
Well, we use it that way.
Well, we do use it that way. Don't get me wrong here. I'm not condoning that use. In fact, I would like to see it handed back to Cuba. I'm just saying I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, I agree with you. I don't think it's going to happen. I think that the yet-to-be-written treaty between the United States and Cuba should be a very interesting document.
Indeed. Yes.
Anyway.
Let's go back to the phones. Yo mama.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's how Steve introduced you. Please, continue.
Hi, this is Abe's mom, and since he mentioned me on the radio, I figured in the interest of full disclosure, I would say who I was. As Abe said earlier, his dad and I went to Cuba last year, and I just wanted to share very briefly some of our perspectives. We were there for a week. We traveled back and forth from Miami to the island on U.S. carriers, American going and Sun Country coming back to Miami. Mm-hmm. They kept us incredibly busy. In fact, I would say almost too busy. You could barely come up for air. But that might have been a reflection of the fact that the travel documents that we received from the State Department via our travel agency specified that it was to be an educational and a cultural tour and that there was to be no beach time. The
documents, no beach time?
Yes, they, it actually said that.
Well, if you can't get skin cancer, what the hell's the point?
And so we joked a lot about how we were supposed to learn a lot but not have any fun. The other thing that the State Department specified is that we had to keep a diary of our entire week there. So rather than writing one down, I made a very detailed slideshow. Hmm. The educational and healthcare systems were very impressive, I thought. The whole place was very clean. As you said, there are cars all over the place, and 50s U.S. cars, and there's a whole cottage industry around keeping them running. Toyota engines, all kinds of things go into them, and they are in immaculate condition, and they are absolutely beautiful, and they are everywhere. So people who are fans of particularly 50s cars and some early 60s and, well, not really early 60s and some late 40s cars would be very pleased to go there. It's incredibly safe. Our tour guide told us that you can go downtown Havana at 2 a.m. and not have to worry about anything. I'm not sure why that is the case, but it is. The thing that I found to be the single most interesting thing, however, was that the state architect, we met with the state architect, and they are doing a restoration of old Havana down to the woods that were used in the 16th and 17th centuries and all the design. I mean, it's a very precise activity. But everything is not, you know, roses and sunshine. There's considerable poverty still or low income. There's been really restricted opportunities for people, although that's opening up as far as small businesses getting a chance to do this and that. Almost nobody has a car because they can't afford it. I mean, it's just too expensive. So I would, and one of the last things that we thought is that there are tourists everywhere there, and have been for a long time, but they're mostly Canadians with a good dose of Europeans as well. And we had mixed feelings that we opened up to the U.S., maybe the place might be overrun in a unpleasant way with tourism. But I just wanted to share those perspectives with you and thank you for the history as well as the opportunity.
Well, thanks, Mom.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. All right, 2318187. We got a little time.
Yeah, we do. Who's next, Steve? Let's get one more call. Ross, good morning.
Hey, am I on the air?
Yes.
Well, hey, that was a great call from your mom.
Thanks.
Abe.
We'll be teasing Abe about that for a long time.
That was beautiful to hear some real concrete detail.
Yeah.
I want to draw attention to. I guess I should say it straight out. Joe, I think you're sometimes you're a little cynical.
No.
I hope that. Yes, I don't think I'm the first person to say that. But my goodness, you apply that cynicism to Cuba. Well, I think it's worth a test now. And also we have a notion that that Cuba somehow was a Soviet enterprise, and it belies the fact that the history in Cuba was so so filled with left successes. You know, the Communist Party and the unions were extremely powerful in Cuba, especially in the sugar industry. The sugar industry was not like a bunch of rural workers. They were an industrialized proletariat. And so the political consciousness that forms the present revolution is so deep and strong. I think that you'll be surprised that if they have weathered all the historical challenges, I think it would be an overplay of imagining huge American might and
I hope you're
chauvinism
right.
to imagine that our little entrance into Cuba is going to be so devastating.
Well, I hope you're right. We have to fade you out because we've run out of time. I do appreciate the comments.
Yes, thanks, everybody.
I want to thank all of you. And we'll be back at you next week.
Yes, indeed. Thanks for calling in.
Is a proud co-sponsor of Smoldering Fires, produced by Passenart. The play runs from March 11th through April 10th at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center in Portland. Smoldering Fires explores how to apply the ideas and struggles of the civil rights movement to contemporary city life through the point of view of two young friends who differ in temperament and approach. Again, that's Smoldering Fires, March 11th through April 10th at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center, 5340 Northeast Interstate Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO.
This KBOO program is made possible in part.
Whoa. Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on